Well, hello. This is the inaugural show, the very first Caveman Radio show. So this is pretty exciting for me. What I'm doing here is getting a new thing going with my Enlightened Caveman concept. So let me jump right in. The first thing is, who am I? My name is Chris Wilson, and I came up with a concept in 2003 called the Enlightened Caveman Concept. I wrote a book about it that was entitled Healing the Unhappy Caveman, Why the Human Mind Was Not Designed for Happiness and What You Can Do About It, and published that book in 2007. You can find information about me at www.enlightenedcaveman.com, and you can also find the book on amazon.com. So what I'm going to do is give you a little bit of a background on the book and the concept, and then we'll dive right into the topic, which is Thomas Sowell's new book called Intellectuals in Society. So I wrote the book, as I said, and I wrote it, finished it in about 2003 and finally published it in 2007, and published it with a very small publisher because my efforts to try to get published by some of the big New York and West Coast publishers were met with the standard sort of, you don't have a platform, we don't know who you are, you don't have a PhD, and therefore we're not interested, which was fine. I'm not bitter about that. It took me a while to get it published, and the way I got it published I was very happy with. And over the course of a few years, I've blogged intermittently about it, and over time, life kind of becomes something that takes over, and your time goes away, and so blogging kind of fell in the background. I've always been interested in talk radio and figuring out some way to do it, and now that Blog Talk Radio is here, it's given me an opportunity to try it. So I hope you'll bear with me. The first thing I want to do is go into the Enlightened Caveman concept. So I'll start with the idea, which is that just as our thumbs exist and look and operate as they do because they facilitated the survival of our ancestors, so too are our brains designed to work in a certain way. And that basic functioning is determined by our genes. I think most people generally get that. Of course, culture plays a big role in what we see today, but the underlying mental framework is genetic, and it's the same as it was 20-plus thousand years ago. And this is because as soon as humans mastered their environment, natural selection, which is that pressure that pushes adaptation along, subsided. The genetics of the brain have remained pretty much the same since then. So we have the minds of cavemen, at least out of the box, and I hope you'll forgive the pun there. But it brings up a question. So what adaptations, caveman adaptations, are built into the human mind? And it turns out that at least as far as evolutionary psychologists are concerned, that our brains come with a variety of mental modules or organs that govern aspects of how we perceive and react to the world. It's well beyond the scope of either my book or this program to go into all of them. The ones we're interested in here are the ones that were the keys to survival of humans, the social modules. One of them being the notion of reciprocal altruism, the other being the notion of status. The first, reciprocal altruism, is about cooperation. That's why we're here, and the other hominids that were around back in caveman days are not. Our species developed the ability to account for favors done and favors owed, and that was all mediated by emotions. When cooperation goes well, as in favors are repaid and alliances are built, our alliances are being tightened, emotions that lead to friendship and bonding are there. Somewhere in there with pair bonding is love. On the other hand, when cooperation breaks down, that is, someone screws someone over, you see emotions like anger, guilt, and so on. The key here is that emotions that we experience today are thought to have arisen to push us to cooperate with one another as cavemen, kind of like Pavlov's dogs. Good emotions you salivate, bad emotions you recoil. And the other module, the status engine, was also key because it brought out the human A game. That is to say, there were limited resources, food, shelter, mates, etc., so hierarchies developed to divide up what was available. It also made humans get better and better at all of the things that were needed for survival, as any sort of hierarchical kind of environment will do. Competition, as we all pretty much understand implicitly, makes the people in the game better. So thus, humans developed a mechanism to pursue status and keep it at all costs, since the consequences of being on bottom meant a childless death. And when you die without kids, your genes die with you. So status seeking is facilitated by all sorts of lovely emotions, such as greed, envy, indignance, pride, and so on. My argument, the central thesis of the Enlightened Caveman concept, is that these emotions are running the show for most people, even though they don't know it. And the result is often disastrous when it comes to happiness. This is because we live in a world that bears no resemblance to the environment of our cave-dwelling ancestors. Thus, we pursue status because our emotions tell us to, and we suffer for it. We try to forge typically altruistic relationships and often get betrayed, and we suffer for it. But it doesn't have to be that way. If we understand what our emotions are pushing us to do, we can actually take steps to minimize their negative impacts. We can choose not to let our emotions drive our behaviors, and when those behaviors will cause us to suffer down the road. When we do this, we are what I call enlightened cavemen and women. So that's the background. Now, the point here is to talk about Thomas Sowell's new book, Intellectuals in Society. I want to do that, but I want to make sure to tie aspects of it into the enlightened caveman concept. I find that because this caveman stuff is so pervasive, you can tie it into pretty much anything. And after doing that for a few years on my blog, it started feeling like I was recycling the same material. Now, however, with a radio platform and picking specific books, I think it's possible to make it somewhat new again, and we'll see. So a couple of disclaimers and housekeeping notes. First, I have no freaking idea what I'm doing here. I mean, this is my first time using Blog Talk Radio, so I may very well royally screw it up. Second, because I wrote a book about enlightened caveman, the enlightened caveman doesn't mean that I hold myself out to be this guru of enlightenment. Far from it. I have moments when I feel like I'm in control and my caveman emotions are in the back seat. Other times I'm as out of control as anyone. But these are things to aspire to in life, so I press on and try to enjoy the ride. Lastly, I'll be taking calls on the show. The interface that I have just presents me with phone numbers, and that's a little too random. So if you want to be on, call. And then send an email to ec@enlightenedcaveman.com. Put your phone number in the subject line and then tell me briefly in the note what you want to talk about. We'll see how well I can multitask screening calls and talking at the same time. If I fail, I'll refer you back to my first disclaimer, which is that I have no idea what's happening. So let's get started. Thomas Sowell is definitely one of my favorite authors. He's a columnist that's written a lot on mainly economics, politics, things like that. He's obviously a conservative kind of guy. And that's one of his big things. But he's also written a lot of books. And he's written books about economics, and he's written books about social phenomenon, political phenomenon. And this book, when I first started reading it, seemed to be a real step forward. It was a culmination of a lot of his previous work. But as I got closer to the end, I realized that it's really more of an extension and elaboration of his classic, which is called A Conflict of Visions. And he just drills down into the core reason for the proliferation of what he calls the vision of the anointed. Now, not that that's a bad thing. I don't think that's bad at all. It was a fantastic book, and for him to dig deeper into it and provide a little bit more information about it, to me, seems great. By the way, I probably should tell you what the guest call-in phone number is if you're not able to see that on your view. The number is 347-945-5417. So moving on, to start us off, what I want to do is read a few very inflammatory quotes from the summary of the book. Then I'll go back and give some groundwork for what he's talking about, and from there we'll kind of go freestyle and see what happens. So the first one I'll start with, and these are comments where he is basically summarizing what he calls intellectuals and the intelligentsia have contributed to society and the world at large. So we'll start off with this one. The intelligentsia have largely ignored or downplayed the things in which Americans lead the world, including philanthropy, technology, and the creation of life-saving medicines, and treated the errors, flaws, and shortcomings that Americans share with human beings around the world as special defects of our society. They encourage people who are contributing nothing to the world to complain and even organize protests because others are not doing enough for them. They have rationalized the breaking of laws by those who choose to picture themselves as underdogs fighting an oppressive system, even when these are college students from affluent homes. They have, both in America and in France, verbally turned military heroes who put their lives on the line for their country into victims of war, people whom one might pity but never want to emulate. In the schools and colleges, the intelligentsia have changed the role of education from equipping students with the knowledge and intellectual skills to weigh issues and make up their own minds into a process of indoctrination with the conclusions already reached by the anointed. They have put the people whose work creates the goods and services that sustain a rising standard of living on the same plane as people who refuse to work but who are depicted as nevertheless entitled to their fair share of what others have created. The intelligentsia have created the conclusions of their vision as axioms to be followed rather than hypotheses to be tested. Some among the intelligentsia have treated reality itself as subjective or illusory, thereby putting current intellectual fashions and fads on the same plane as verified knowledge and the cultural wisdom distilled from generations of experience. Intellectuals give people who have the handicap of poverty the further handicap of a sense of victimhood. They have acted as if they are anointed to decide which segments of society to favor, who should be allowed to pick their own associations and who should not, which small risks people should be forbidden to take and which larger risks are all right. They have romanticized cultures that have left people mired in poverty, violence, disease, and chaos, while trashing cultures that have led the world in prosperity, medical advances, and law and order. In doing so, they have often disregarded or even filtered out the fact that masses of people were fleeing the societies intellectuals romanticized to go to the societies they condemned. The intelligentsia have been quick to find excuses for crime and equally quick to attribute wrongdoing to police, even when discussing things for which they have neither expertise nor experience, such as shootings. Excuse me, taking a little drink there. They have encouraged the poor to believe that their poverty is caused by the rich, a message that may be a passing annoyance to the rich, but a lasting handicap to the poor, who may see less need to make fundamental changes in their own lives that could lift themselves up, instead of focusing their efforts on tearing others down. The intelligentsia have acted as if their ignorance of why some people earn unusually high incomes is a reason why those incomes are either suspect or ought not to be permitted. Intellectuals have, on issues ranging across the spectrum from housing policies to laws governing organ transplants, sought to have decision-making discretion taken from those directly involved who have personal knowledge and a personal stake and transferred to third parties who have neither and who pay no price for being wrong. They have filtered information in the media, in the schools, and in academia to leave out things that threaten their vision of the world. Above all, they exalt themselves by denigrating the society in which they live and turning its members against each other. The revealed preference of the intelligentsia, whether the specific subject is crime, economics, or other things, is not only to be conspicuously different from society at large, but also and almost axiomatically superior to society, either intellectually, morally, or both. Their vision of the world is not only a vision of causation in the world as it exists and a vision of what the world ought to be like, it is also a vision of themselves as a self-anointed vanguard leading toward that better world. Those whose specific ideas or general vision are different, the benighted, are often treated as unworthy obstacles to progress, nuisances to be disregarded, circumvented, or discredited, rather than as people on the same moral and intellectual plane whose arguments are to be engaged factually and logically. Perhaps most important of all, the vision of the anointed represents a huge investment of ego in a particular set of opinions, and therefore a major obstacle to reconsideration of those opinions in light of evidence and experience. No one likes to admit being wrong, but few have such a large personal stake in the set of beliefs as those with the vision of the anointed, or so few countervailing incentives to reconsider. The ruthlessness with which the anointed assail others and the doggedness with which they cling to their beliefs in defiance of ever-mounting evidence against the root causes of crime and other social theories, for example, is evidence of that large personal investment in a set of social or political opinions. So I think it's safe to say that Sal hits pretty hard in this book. If you've read any of his stuff, you know that a lot of this is pretty consistent with some of the stuff that he talks about, whether it's in his columns or in his other books. He's an economist, by trade, so he knows what he's talking about. He comes from the Hoover Institution, which is obviously a conservative institution, and I should probably point out that where my politics are, I'm a libertarian, but I would consider myself a philosophical libertarian, which is to say that I come down on the side of I am fiscally conservative, as in I believe in free markets and very little government intervention, but I am socially liberal, as in I believe the government really doesn't have much of a role to play in types of moralistic decisions that people make. So that being said, when we talk about things like conservative economics, I tend to find that kind of argument appealing and makes sense to me. When we talk about things like gay marriage and things like that, I tend to fall on the side of liberals who feel like it's no problem. I tend to agree with that. So I don't want to come off as just another conservative guy doing a talk show, because that's really I think that's probably an improper label of where I'm coming from. So those are the kind of the inflammatory statements that I wanted to start off with. And let me remind you that the phone number to call in is 347-945-5419. I don't have anybody on the switchboard at the moment, so if you call, you're going to get on, and we're going to talk about this. Let me go ahead and give you a little background on the how Saul is framing this entire discussion. So what is an intellectual? I think that's the very first thing to get into. He defines intellectuals as people whose jobs are dealing in ideas. So you can think of somebody like a surgeon or a electrical engineer as – you can think of somebody like that as obviously somebody who's intelligent, but they don't deal strictly in ideas. They actually deal in concrete production. So things that they do are concrete, and it's very obvious whether they're successful or not successful. Intellectuals, on the other hand, as far as Saul defines them, are people who deal strictly in ideas, and there really is no external test to determine whether those ideas are successful or not successful. In fact, he talks a lot about the idea that intellectuals, the only test they have is really internal, which is to say their peers, people who also are intellectuals, and whether they agree with them and whether they think what they say makes sense. Now, on its face, this would seem to be academics, and that definitely is the case. He talks a lot about academics as being, intellectuals, some of them being public intellectuals, and some of them being intellectuals who are just working within academia. He also talks about the intelligentsia, which is you can think of the intelligentsia as a group of people who are connected to intellectuals, as in the media, whose job it is to understand and absorb and then report, distribute, in other words, edit the information that's coming from intellectuals. So when you take intellectuals and the intelligentsia, you have this tremendous force for putting ideas out into the general public. And Saul's big argument in the book, which is very, very obvious from what I read already, is that a lot of what they're putting out there is complete lunacy. It doesn't make any sense at all. And the reason that they do this and the kinds of things that they put out are because they feel that they are superior. So here's the tie-in. Here's the tie-in to the enlightened caveman concept. Here we have people, and, I don't want to come off as somebody who is against people who are in academia or against intellectuals or against people who have PhDs and paint them with a big broad brush and say that they all adhere to Saul's definition of intellectual. But it is important to note that a lot of what he's talking about just makes sense if you think about what somebody where somebody comes from a superiority perspective. So he talks about the idea of knowledge, and he talks about how people who are professional academics are people who have a specific amount of knowledge that they have developed, and it's specialized knowledge. It's knowledge of a particular topic. So let's say you're talking about a historian. You'll have a historian who knows everything there is to know about the Civil War. And what he talks about is that the interesting thing about intellectuals is that unlike, say, a brain surgeon who just by virtue of doing his job automatically has a lot of respectability and a lot of, we'll say, deference from a society perspective, unlike that, a historian is really only going to be known among other historians. Somebody that really knows everything there is to know about the Civil War might write papers or books about the Civil War, but unless you're a Civil War buff, they're not likely to make it onto your radar screen. So Saul says, this is the big problem for intellectuals. So here are some people who somebody's got a PhD, so clearly has specialized knowledge, has the highest level of a degree that you can have, and yet does not have a means by which he can be well known in the public. And So what do they do? How do they respond to this? Well, the way that they respond is by stepping outside of their area of expertise and offering their opinions and their thoughts about things that they really don't know anything about. Thus, you'll have somebody like Noam Chomsky, who is known for being a linguist, and he's very, very well known and very well respected as a linguist. He came up with a lot of the theories around linguistics, it's built in, and that we have the grammar gene and all that. That's all straight from Noam Chomsky. So here's a guy who is very well respected in that, and then he comes out and he starts talking about things like politics and things like social policy and economic policy, things for which he does not have specialized knowledge. However, the things that he says are so contrary in a lot of ways to what the masses believe that his peers say, wow, this guy is really sharp, and then all of a sudden he's famous. And so Sal offers this sort of scenario for how you take somebody who is a very, very knowledgeable person in a very specific area of study, and they generalize outside of their area of study and their area of expertise, and they become famous. And then all of a sudden, this fame and this repute that they've got among their peers all of a sudden starts filtering its way into the intelligentsia. So now the journalists start picking it up. And he talks about how all of this works, and he talks about this concept of the conflict of visions, how there are two general visions out there. Now, I wrote about this in part of my book because I feel like this whole caveman concept is really heavily, heavily at play here. And let me explain what I'm talking about. So I talked about status and how status is a core module, and it's one of the big components that caused humans to move forward and succeed while other hominids did not. So let's talk about that for a second. Here we have an academic, somebody who is told their entire life, probably, wow, you're really smart, you're smarter than other people. So their status engine is being stoked the whole time they're growing up. Then they get into school and they start going for their PhD. Now they're to the point where among their friends and family, people that know them, they're Dr. So-and-so, which again is stoking their status engine. And then they get into their position. So they've been a doctor for a while and they start writing their books. And now where's their fame? Where's the big, it kind of starts to dissipate. You know, they're in an academia among, you know, hundreds and hundreds of other academics, hundreds and hundreds of other PhDs. So where's the status? They were on the top, and now they're not. And so anytime you start to see that happen, you can pretty much assume that what somebody's going to do is try to find a way to get back on top. And, you know, we don't have to restrict this conversation to talking about people in academia. We can talk about movie stars. We can talk about, you know, the where are they now celebrities. We can talk about this massive cabal of television shows that are on right now, reality shows that are on right now, trying to revive stars who have been long washed up, who are coming back and trying their best to get into it. And all of this is driven by the status gene. They want to get back on top. They want the status. So how this entire concept ties into the enlightened caveman concept is that this vision, and I'll go into what the visions are in a moment, this vision is directly tied. The vision that these academics, these experts, these intellectuals have is, I believe, directly tied to the status engine, as in their status engine is tapping them on the shoulder and saying, you need more status, and you're not getting it by writing books about history because people don't care about that, and you're not the high man on the totem pole because you're just another PhD in a sea of hundreds of other PhDs. You have to do something to get yourself out there. So what can they do? Now let's talk about the two visions. The two visions are essentially what Sal calls the tragic vision, which I really hate that because it has such a negative connotation to it, and it happens to be the vision that I share. And so I don't want my vision to be tragic. I want my vision to make sense. I would think of it as a realistic vision. And then there's the unconstrained vision, or as Sal likes to put it, the vision of the anointed. So we'll cover first the tragic vision, or the constrained vision. The constrained vision sees the world in a very realistic way by saying that humans are naturally flawed. filled with flaws, and that the natural state for human beings is a state where they're disorganized, where they're doing bad things to one another, they're cheating on one another. Now, granted, cooperation in general, but the presence, the ever presence of people who are going to do bad things to other people, and that's the tragic vision. That's why it's called tragic, as in not everybody is nice, not everybody is great. So the tragic vision is constrained in the sense that no matter what you do, you will never, ever have a humanity that does not look like that, so that doesn't have its share of bad people who will do bad things to other people to get what they want. So that's the constrained vision. The unconstrained vision, or as Saul puts it, the vision of the anointed, is completely the opposite. It believes that man is perfectible, and that the only reason that man is not perfect is because of the institutions that surround him. So you hear quotes like, you know, man is born free, but he's everywhere in chains. These kinds of quotes are indicative of the unconstrained vision. People who believe that crime would not happen were it not for poverty. People who believe that wars would not happen if people just understood one another and just conversed with one another, they are people who hold the unconstrained vision. Now, what gets at the heart of this entire conversation about intellectuals in society is, and I think this was the big step forward for Saul from the book Conflict of Visions, is here he's really drilling into the concept of where does the unconstrained vision come from. And he never really explicitly asks the question in the book, but there's no question that this is really what he's aiming at. This is really what he's talking about, which is he's essentially explaining how does the unconstrained vision emerge, and then how does it get filtered down and accepted by the masses, or at least by huge contingents of the masses. And one of the things he notes is that, you know, these things kind of, they ebb and flow. So at some point you've got lots and lots of people with the constrained vision, as in while World War II is happening, people tend to have this idea that, maybe mankind isn't perfectible, and maybe it isn't all of these, you know, if we're just nice to people, they'll be nice to us. Leading up to World War II, disarmament was all people could talk about. So everybody was so horrified after World War I that the intelligentsia and the intellectuals were all about disarmament, disarm, disarm, disarm. And what they argued was that if we disarm, then we will no longer pose a threat, and if we no longer pose a threat, no one will see any reason to attack us or mess with us. That was their argument. And their argument was a fully unconstrained argument, as in, if we remove the external circumstances that lead to the bad behavior goes away. Now, obviously, they were proven quite wrong by the events that unfolded in the late 30s, and then eventually in the 40s when things got really, really bad, in the early 40s when things got really bad. And so following World War II, you know, toward the end of World War II and then following World War II, there was a big swing toward more of a constrained vision. People started to understand that it isn't a matter of whether you're nice to people, and it isn't a matter of whether you understand them or you take away their reasons, what you believe to be their reasons for attacking you or for being defensive or being upset. It is just that some people will do bad things to other people no matter what. And if you give them the opportunity to do it, you make it more likely that they will do that. So that's kind of the concept of the constrained versus unconstrained vision. Now, if we go back to intellectuals and we start talking about what do the intellectuals, how did this unconstrained vision find so much acceptance out in the world? Well, it goes like this. If I'm a historian and I, you know, again, I go back to the status engine, I'm looking for some way to get back on top, some way to get recognized, to get some kind of acclaim, something that makes me feel like my status engine is going, yeah, you're on top, everything's going well. If I'm looking for something to do, let's talk about my range of possibilities. What could I do? Well, I could come out and I could say something like, let's say it's, you know, it's the it's 1946, 1947, I could come out and say something like, well, we need to make sure that we maintain a very, very strong national defense, because in doing so, we will deter someone from attacking us or trying anything like Hitler did. Well, if you come out and say something like that, the whole world is going to say, and why is this important? Why do we care? You're saying the same thing that everybody is saying. And so you get the idea right there that what these people can do and what they absolutely do is they come out and they say the exact opposite of what the masses are saying, and they come up with some you know, Sowell talks about it as verbal virtuosity. He brings it up again and again. He says, you know, here intellectuals have the ability to twist words in ways that make things sound like they make sense, like using the term social justice and things like that, so that, you know, we're, you know, who's not for social justice? So this becomes the tool that they use to come out with something that is contrary to what the masses believe, and then they sell it internally within their peer group, as in, doesn't this make sense? And, of course, their peer group, all looking for the very same status, all looking to be looked at by everyone else as important and anointed. There comes the vision of the anointed concept. They're all looking for that possibility, and so they all start to clap and say, you're right, that totally makes sense. We need to disarm. If we take away the reasons why they'll attack us, then they won't have any reason to attack us anymore, and we'll never get attacked, and everybody will be happy. And so this is what leads, you know, it talks a lot about intellectuals and how they live in this insulated world that doesn't have any external consequences. So somebody can come out, somebody who is an intellectual who earns their living dealing in ideas, they can come out and they can say something preposterous like, we need to completely disarm because when we do that, everything will be fine. And there are no consequences for saying this, even if World War II erupts. And the fact in some country that disarmed, or there were definitely treaties that drew down the size of battleships that we could build and the size of battleships that they built in Britain. Yet when things really got heated up, the Japanese had huge battleships. They had signed the same agreements, but they just negated them. They didn't care. They had no reason to hold on to these agreements. So here, the intellectuals directly contributed to the signing of agreements that were signed by the Allied powers, directly contributed to that, which put the Allied powers at a major disadvantage when things really heated up. Yet there were no consequences whatsoever for any of the people that argued that disarmament was the right white way to go. None. None of those people were fired from their jobs. They were not vilified in the press. No consequences whatsoever. So as Sowell talks about this, he talks about how these are people that live in an insulated world where the only thing that really matters is the approval of their peers. Now, this really wouldn't be a big deal if it were not for the fact that the intelligentsia is right there next to them, ready to report whatever it is they have to say. So here's where this concept of status, this concept of the anointed, this is where it really comes into play. You have people who are looking for a way to get themselves back on top, so they come up with ideas that they believe. You know, these are not the big thing about it that Sal talks about again and again and again is that you can't look at these people and say these are evil, bad people. You could just say that these people are just kind of doing their thing, and it just turns out the way it turns out. And I tend to agree with that, especially if you put it into the context of the enlightened caveman concept. These are people who are acting on the direction of their genes. Their genes are driving their emotions, which are driving their behaviors, and they have no idea that this is happening. But what they've developed is this sense that they are the elite in society. They are the ones that need to be driving the decisions that are being made all over. So when they look at what the masses believe, let's say it's 1946 and the masses believe in a strong defense, they look at that and they have this really strange backwards argument, which is that if the masses believe it, it must be wrong. There's no let's examine the logic of this argument, that let's examine the data available, let's put it through a rigorous hypothesis testing kind of procedure. They don't have to do any of that. They start with the basis. The premise is, if the masses believe it, it must be wrong. And this is based in the notion that they are the ones with specialized knowledge. They're the ones with PhDs. They're the ones who are very, very smart and have been told their entire lives that they're smart. They have status. And therefore, those who are below them do not have status and do not have the brain power to weigh in on these issues. And what's interesting about this is that when someone assumes this kind of a mental position, they have no reason whatsoever to argue with anyone that they deem to be below them. Which is why, and I've found this again and again, when I've gotten into discussions about politics and things like that with academics, I've found again and again and again that they are so completely arrogant and condescending toward me. You know, they talk to me as if I'm incapable of understanding the concepts that they're mentioning to me. They throw out things that would be ideas to be batted back and forth as axioms, and then just stand there. And then if I disagree with the statement, then that then immediately, rather than deal with the actual statement, as in here's a point, let's make a counterpoint, and let's have a discussion until we get someplace. They immediately either assume that I'm adult and have no idea what I'm talking about, so they just condescend and basically end the conversation. Or the other side of it is they assume that I am a morally bankrupt human being, that in believing something like we definitely need to maintain some kind of strong defense in order to deter people who would attack us, they automatically go to, wow, how can you be for war? How can you be for Holocaust? How can you be for the death of women and children? Which is completely absurd. I don't know anybody. I never have met anybody that is for the death of women and children. I don't know that those people are. I'm sure they're out there. The constrained vision tells me that they must be out there, but I've certainly never met anybody like that. Yet this is a very, very common argument that is thrown, and it's not an argument. I mean, it's really not. An argument would be, okay, so you believe that we should have a strong defense because it deters people from doing things to us. Let's look at the facts. That's an argument. Let's go back and say, well, I disagree, and the reason I disagree is because history shows us this, 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 and this. But that doesn't seem to be the case. I never experienced that. What I always experience when I'm dealing with academics, if we get into any kind of political discussion, which, by the way, I don't do anymore. I mean, I'm not a glutton for punishment, and I know that I'm not going to get anywhere. But it's very interesting that when you get into these discussions with people who have this perception of their own personal status above and beyond those who do not have their same credentials and don't share their same vision, there's no need to argue. They're not going to argue with you. They're going to put you down or put down anybody that disagrees with them. So Sowell goes to great lengths to explain that this is the reality. This is, once they adopt this vision, they have a major investment in keeping the vision going. And so what it means is that they argue and argue and argue for things that support the vision. Anything that does not support the vision either gets filtered out, or if it doesn't get filtered out, it gets bashed, and the person who's delivering that argument gets denigrated or attacked for being morally bankrupt or just stupid. This is the way of things. And again, it wouldn't be a big deal if it were just intellectuals in academia that were doing this, because, you know, most of the time people wouldn't really know who they were and they wouldn't really care. But you go one level down and you've got the intelligentsia. And so these are the people who are desperate to also separate themselves from the masses. And in doing so, they look for people like these intellectuals, these professional intellectuals. They look for them. They look to them for opinions. They look to them for thoughts about what's right and what's wrong, what should be reported, what shouldn't be reported. And here you have a mechanism for the transmission of the unconstrained vision down to the masses. And what's very interesting about this is that it all appeals to the status engine within the brain. So when someone takes this high and mighty approach of, I'm a lot smarter than you are, I'm equipped to weigh in on these issues and you are not, then your response is to either say, you know, that doesn't make sense, that's completely absurd, or you could also take the response of, you know what, you've changed my mind. I hadn't thought about it like that. And you know what? I'm really privileged that you were able to share this with me, and I'm on board. I get it. I used to be for strong national defense, and now I'm not. Now I see the folly of that. It just doesn't make sense. So here you have somebody's status engine, their caveman brain, is kicking off saying, I can attain status by aligning myself with these people. So this is a very, very interesting way that the unconstrained vision filters its way down into society. Now, what's you know, the natural consequence of this, or maybe another way to peel back the onion and look at it, is to say, now, if we look at the distribution of people who have the unconstrained vision versus the distribution of people who have the constrained vision, we notice interesting things that are very similar to election trends, which is that we see that the coasts have people who have the unconstrained vision, as in people who are heavily liberal. And then you have the inner parts of the United States, people have the constrained vision. People are mostly conservative. And obviously, if you just look surface area-wise, you can see that the United States has a heck of a lot more space on the inside than it does on the periphery, which is probably what explains why, when you look at polls, people tend to be more conservative than liberal in general within the country. A point that really is very interesting because it baffles the minds of people who have the unconstrained vision, yet it's perfectly logical, and it's perfectly in keeping with their vision, which is to say that they're the smart ones and most people are not. And most people shouldn't get what they want and shouldn't see things the way they see things. And it would be such an interesting turn of events if all of a sudden everybody did become liberal, because then the anointed would no longer be anointed. They would be thinking the same thing that everybody else thinks, and I wonder what they would do. I wonder how their minds would change and where their vision would go, because Sowell's point, which I completely agree with, is that the vision of the anointed is whatever keeps them separated and elite from everybody else. So it's completely malleable. It isn't something that is rooted in any kind of true philosophy or any true set of ideals or principles. It is a moving target. It is a floating point, and it changes based upon what's happening in society. He makes a very interesting point about how prior to World War I, the intelligentsia, the intellectuals, were very much for all of the imperialistic exploits that were going on, where, you know, the United States was getting involved in Latin America, and it was all nation-building kind of stuff, the spread of democracy, and if we've got to go in and you know, break some heads to achieve justice, then that's what we'll do. And what was very interesting was that when World War I came about and they saw the horrors that could come about from this, they backed up, and after the fact, now they were pacifists, and now they were for disarmament, and that was what led right up to World War II. So the point here is that these intellectuals and the intelligentsia that hang on to them, they don't actually have a creed that is, we'll say, conservative in the sense of it is conserved over time. It is completely malleable, completely moving target kind of thing. So I guess one of the things that I also want to talk about with respect to this, and I want to go through kind of – I'm not going to go much more through the book, because what I'd like for you to do is read it and see what you think of it, and you can let me know on my blog or just, you know, let somebody else know. The idea is – I think this is important because Sowell talks a lot about what happens when you adopt this vision of the anointed. And to me, one of the key concepts of the enlightened caveman thing is this notion of understanding who you are and why you think the way you think. So when I wrote the book, it wasn't a matter of, aha, I know these things about you, and I'm going to tell these things to you. When I wrote the book, it was because I was in the process of discovering these things about myself and about how I thought about things. And I had moment after moment of disillusionment where I said, wow, I used to really want a Rolex. And then I realized the only reason I wanted a Rolex was so that other people could see me wearing a Rolex and would think that I had money and thus status. And it was realizations like that that were kind of painful when they first happened, but they also, once they wore off a little bit, I felt better. I felt like I was in a better place as a human being. And so writing the book was a cathartic process for me. It changed me as a human being, and it has continued to change me over the years. But one of the things that I think was instrumental in that was forcing me to take a look in the mirror and see who I am as a person. And what I think is the most important thing about Sal's book, and he doesn't talk about this at all. Everything is very, very third party. He's not talking to you, the reader. He's talking about stuff. And that's his style. That's what he's always done. I tend to take things and say, all right, so now that we've presented this set of ideas, what does this mean to you and me, the average person reading a book like this? And what I come up with is, think of all the people you know who have the unconstrained vision. And what about, you know, so I'm talking to you, somebody who is, that has this unconstrained vision, and wouldn't be willing to admit that you have this vision. Maybe you would see it after this diatribe that I've gone on for all this time. Maybe you would see it as, well, that's not me, and maybe that's the case. But I'm talking to you, someone who believes in things like it is the external world that controls what happens to individual people, as in a person who commits a crime is not necessarily responsible for that crime because of the situation of his or her growing up. They were poor. They had an alcoholic father. They were abused. They were the victims of crimes themselves. They lived in a neighborhood where crime was happening. Someone who, if you're one of those people and you believe that kind of stuff, here's my challenge to you. Think about why you believe that. Do you believe that because there are people who are intellectuals, academics, people you respect, who you feel are the smartest people out there, and they believe it, and therefore it only makes sense that you should believe it? Because if that's your reasoning, if that's why you believe it, then I can tell you right now, you have put yourself in a logical mess. Because the only way for you to have a belief about something that can hold for a long period of time is to examine it from a rational perspective. So throw out the hypothesis. If somebody has committed a crime because of their circumstances, there are a variety of ways that you can examine the truth of that statement. There's lots and lots of data. There are lots and lots of studies. And most of those studies will show you that the murder rate in the United States was going down dramatically, and it was half of what it had been in the 1930s by the 1960s until all of the social changes that were adopted in the late 60s, until all of that happened, and then all of a sudden the murder rate went crazy. It went through the roof. And so there you have a very, very puzzling statistic. If crime is due to external situations, and external situations have gotten a lot better since the 60s, yet crime has gone through the roof, then you have a problem. You have a logical problem. But the thing is, most people that believe these kinds of things will not examine those beliefs. And moreover, as I'm sitting here saying this to you, I can guarantee you that there are people on the other end listening saying, this guy is an asshole. He does not care about people. He doesn't care about what they think. He doesn't care about what trials and tribulations people have gone through. He is a militant conservative asshole. I can guarantee you that's the response that people have. And I'm telling you, if that's your response, I would just ask you to think about it for a second. Why do you believe what you believe? Because it's really absurd to think that there are people out there, lots and lots and lots of people out there, more people out there who hold the constrained vision than the unconstrained vision. It's really absurd to think that most of those people are people who don't care. It's just absurd, because what you see, look at what's happening with Haiti right now. The outpouring of money and the outpouring of effort to try to help them is staggering. I have not gone to any kind of social engagement of any sort since the Haiti thing happened, where a conversation about Haiti and what people are doing about it and how amazing it is and what kinds of things people want to do about it. I have not been to a single social thing of any sort, and I don't go to highbrow tea parties where people put their finger out all the time. I go to, you know, various places, and I have not been to anything where people have not talked about the outpouring of support and caring for the people that have been devastated by what's happened there. So the point that I'm making is to just dismiss the views that people have, when someone has the constrained vision and they try to argue that point, to dismiss that as being the view held by somebody who's morally bankrupt, you're really doing yourself a huge disservice. And one of the big points that Sal makes, and it was one of the points in the list that I covered at the beginning, was he talks about how the vision of the anointed is all about dividing people. That is what it's all. That's what they do. They basically have. Let me see if I can find it here in my notes, because it's amazing. Above all, they exalt themselves by denigrating the society in which they live and turning its members against each other. So the point here is that you have the enlightened caveman concept applied to intellectuals in society by saying that where do these intellectuals come from? They are operating on a set of caveman status genes. That's what they're operating strictly on, a program that was built into their brains way, way, way back when. Back when the environment had no burden, was nothing like what it is today. And it's not their fault necessarily that they're like this, because they're in an environment that promotes it, and with incentives that are designed basically, and they're not, I won't say that they're designed, but with incentives that are oriented around seeing that when they step out of their area of expertise and they say something that is completely contrary to what the masses believe, that they're going to be rewarded for it, that they're going to be applauded for it, that their peers are going to say, wow, what a bold thing to step out and say, he's totally right, he's turned it on its head, he's taken what the masses believe and made them understand that it doesn't make any sense. So I think that's the big takeaway from all of this, is that if you think about where the vision, the unconstrained vision, comes from, it is clearly something that is generated by caveman status genes in academia, filtered down through the intelligentsia, who want to be aligned with these people who are clearly the elite, the people who can look down at all the masses and say, ha, I'm better than you, I'm smarter than you, I have special knowledge, I'm educated, I know what I'm talking about, and you don't. That's where it comes from. And so I think it's important to talk about this topic, because if we recognize that and we start to see, especially, you know, what I would love to see happen would be for people who are on the fence, who have these kinds of views, for them to kind of back up and say, wow, it is amazing how much I've been influenced by this group of the intellectuals and the intelligentsia, who have given me this impression that by aligning myself with them that I am somehow in some sort of elevated status within society. If people recognize that and then step back from it, then maybe we can actually get to the point where we start arguing about things in a logical and rational way. I am not by any means advocating a wholly conservative agenda to solve every problem. I don't think that's a good idea. I think there are just as many dirtbags on the side of conservatives as there are on liberals. Democrats, as far as what's in our modern political environment. But what I would like to see would be discourse among people that actually deals in logic, deals in fact, deals in evidence. If you think that the earth is warming, please explain to me why. If you believe that cold weather is indicative of too much CO2 in the atmosphere, please explain why. Don't tell me that the argument is settled. That is called an appeal to authority, and it is a major logical fallacy. You cannot argue a point like that, and I mean, it's appalling. And that's what we have. That's what goes for discourse across the board in this country, when people who are divided and having been divided by intellectuals, when people talk about topics, they're not talking in terms of facts. They're not talking in terms of evidence. And you can have the longest, most spirited debate about facts and evidence, because everybody disagrees as to what is really a fact. And in this day and age, it's very difficult to tell if something's a fact. Even people on the ground in Iraq will come back and say, two different people in two different places in Iraq will come back and say two completely different things about what's happening there. So there's plenty of room to argue. There's plenty of room to be on either side of any debate. So there's nothing in anything that I've said or anything that Sal is recommending that says we all need to march in lockstep believing the same stuff. The point is just that we need to use a different means to think about the issues that are important to all of us, and we need to stop letting intellectuals who have no expertise about what they're talking about, who have no consequences for being wrong, who have no knowledge about the specific topics that they're talking about, or the people who are involved have no stake in the issues that they're talking about. How are we letting these people guide what we think. And then when we encounter somebody who doesn't believe what we believe, instead of taking on their argument, we automatically assume that this person is morally bankrupt. Doesn't make sense to me. So I don't know if I did something wrong on the show. I'm looking at my little switchboard that Blog Talk Radio gives me. And on the right side, it has this little list of all of the callers. And throughout the entire show, it said no caller, no caller, no caller. So I don't know if I did something wrong and people couldn't get on, or if people weren't interested in calling, or if I'm talking to myself in space. It doesn't really matter, because the nice thing about this is that it will be podcasted. You can subscribe to this on iTunes. If you just go to my Blog Talk Radio page, which is blogtalkradio.com, caveman11, you'll see the links to be able to go into this particular show, and you can either download an MP3 of it right there, or you can go over to iTunes and you could subscribe so that the next shows that we do, you can pull those in. And incidentally, the next show that I'm going to do is going to be on a completely different topic, a completely different, we'll say, mood, which is, the book is called Born to Run. And it's by a sports writer called Christopher McDougall. And it's about running a completely different kind of way. It's about a tribe of Indians in Mexico. It's a fantastic book. So if you like to run, if you like any kind of endurance sports, you definitely want to tune in for that one, because we'll talk about the book, and I'll definitely have some interesting stuff to share with you about my own experiences of trying to do a lot of what McDougall talks about in his book. So with that, I think it is time to draw this to a close. Thanks for joining. If you were listening the whole time and didn't call in, shame on you. You suck. You could have called. You had all the room in the world. Wait a second. Hold on a second. There's a caller. Let's put somebody on. Here we go. Hello. Who's on? Who's this?
Christopher.
Can you hear me? Yes.
Good. How's it going?
Hey.
My name is Mark Kirby.
Oh, Mark Kirby. Mark Kirby from Atlanta, Georgia?
From Atlanta, Georgia.
All right. How's it going, Herb?
It's going good. It's going good. I put you on at the very beginning, and a girl came by, and I wasn't able to listen to the whole show, so I really felt bad. I just wanted to see if this was actually working, because I heard that I'm actually hearing it on the way now. I need to turn down my radio. I feel
yeah,
like
you're supposed to
guys.
Turn off your radio. Have you never called into a talk radio show before?
But I just wanted to call and say good job. From what I heard, everything was on point, and I'll have to definitely download the file tomorrow and listen throughout without any interruption.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for calling, Curb.
Yeah, just wanted to see if I could get through.
Yeah. Well, you could easily get through, because you were the only caller.
Well, next time I'll definitely have a lot of other callers calling for you.
I'm not sure if that's a good idea, but
yeah.
But great. Thanks for calling, Curb.
All right. Talk to you
later.
All
right.
Bye.
Okay, so hey, we tried it out. It worked. I added a guest. It was no problem. I think I've got this down. So next show is coming up probably in about a week or a week and a half. So stay tuned to my site, enlightencaveman.com. Take care.